Start this up. We're going to be in Numbers. We're going to be in Numbers chapters 13 and 14. If you want to write down a reference on the side, a couple of references off the side. I don't want to take the time to go there, but Numbers 10:11, and Exodus 19:1. Now, the reason that those two are important is Numbers 10:11 and Exodus 19:1. The reason those two passages are important is it gives you the time frame, roughly, for Kadesh Barnea. Because Israel comes to Sinai about three months after they left Egypt. They set out from Sinai in Numbers 10:11. Numbers 10:11 is when they leave Sinai after. So the temple's all, or the tabernacle's all built. The priesthood is in order, and they leave. And that's 2 years and 2 months from the time they left Egypt, which means that they were at Sinai for a year and 11 months, almost 2 years. They were at Sinai. Roughly in the time. And so they've set out. So this puts it in perspective that they've been gone from Egypt for 2 years. Which, if you keep that in mind for some of the things that are going to be said in this, isn't that long? Peg and I have been here 23 years, and in many ways it's still like, oh, we just came from Iowa. We were just there. No, we've been gone a long time. I've lived outside the state of Iowa longer than I lived in the state of Iowa now. But it still seems like it was just yesterday. I can still see. Anyway, I don't want to get distracted with that. That's important for these people, for some of the things that are going to transpire, that in many ways Israel or Egypt is still somewhat fresh in their minds. It's really only 2 years out. Now, why are we going to study Kadesh Barnea's story? Why is this one of the big stories? The thing is we could say this, most of the stories we could go through in the Bible could be a big story. But why is this one so important? Because this one is going to affect a whole series of other issues. And this is a story that is directly referred to in the New Testament more than once with regard to us, has significance for us. But we're going to save that for another, the next study, which will be in a couple of weeks. Why study this? Because it demonstrates, if you're filling in the blanks, I would say this study demonstrates the chronic lack of faith under the law. In fact, I took a paper down to the forum this year, and in that paper was on faith and the faith. And one of the things that stood out to me was outside of Hebrews 11, where you have people that acts of faith from the Old Testament, you go to the Old Testament and you're looking for acts of faith, you don't find them. Because if you're actually looking for the word faith and the word believe in the Old Testament, most of the time, and I'm serious, I'm saying most of the time, it's you didn't believe, you don't believe, why don't you believe, you're not believing. It's always God saying. I think 10 times in the Old Testament you have positive references to actual people actually believing God. 10 times that if we're told that. Yes, I mean, there are reasons. Yeah, there are reasons. But what we're trying to show is that there generally was a chronic lack of faith under the law. And that's consistent with the fact that Paul tells us in Galatians 3 that there was no faith in law. He says the law is not a thing of faith. You didn't need any faith to keep law. It was purely a matter that there's blessings and there's curses, and you do it or you don't. And that's all there was. And Paul says, so there's no, the law was not a matter of faith. You can go look at that in Galatians chapter 3. So this, Paul uses this as an example and warnings with regard to us. So that's why this is an important story, one of God's big stories in here. We put in Numbers chapter 13, we're going to go to verse 1. It says, then the Lord, and I'm going to read through most of this. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send out for yourselves men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of your father's tribes, each one then a leader or a prince among them. So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, at the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the houses of the sons of Israel. And then he goes through and he gives you a list of each one of them. The one from the, we could go through all these, but the one from the tribe of Judah is Caleb. And the one from the tribe of Ephraim, that's one of Joseph's sons, is Joshua. Just pointing those two guys out, the tribes that they're related to. Verse 16 also tells us, these are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So Moses actually called Joshua by it, or called him Joshua, but his real name was Hoshea. And they're very similar in the Hebrew, but they're not identical. And you can see that related here in your English.
Isn't Ephraim the tribe cursed for doing something?
No. But they are one of the tribes that's caught up in the north eventually and get into trouble. They do have a lot of problems, but they're not. Dan was the tribe that ended up coming into a curse, and they're the tribe that's not mentioned in Revelation chapter 7 when the 12 tribes are mentioned. You have the two tribes of Joseph.
Ephraim did something, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ephraim does end up having problems later on. Right. Verse 17 then says, when Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he said to them, go up there into the Negev. The Negev is the south land. And then go up into the hill country and see what the people are like. And whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, and whether they are few or many. And there's a lot of blanks on here for you to fill out. A lot of them are very straightforward, such as going to what? The hill country. And you're supposed to figure out what are the type of people and the number of people. What is the land, he says in verse 19. Is it a good land or is it a bad land? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they, and this is really quite literal, are they like open camps, like Israel was. Remember, Israel was still living in camps. Is that what their city's like? They're just open camps that are unfortified? Or are they with fortifications? That word fortifications that he uses here is talking about big fortified cities, great and big, shall we say, with towers and walls. And how is the land? Is it a, and I like this, the New American Standard says, is it a fat or a lean land? Some of the Bibles I was reading, they translate that, is it a rich or a poor land? See? If they lived in a part of the world, to be fat was showing success. To be skinny was to show yourself to be impoverished. Okay? Because the people that had, ate. The people that didn't have, couldn't eat. And so that's the way they would describe the land. Talking about whether the land is rich or poor. Is it fat or is it lean? And are there trees in it or are there not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land. Now Moses adds, was the time of the first ripe grapes. And so they went up and they spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob and Lebo Hamath. Zin is a southern city, so they're going from the south all the way up to the north. Lebo Hamath is a city north of Lake Gennesaret, or what we popularly call the Sea of Galilee. Okay, so it's up to the north where they're going. So in other words, they're spying it out from north to, from south to north, we should say. And when they had gone into the Negev, they came to Hebron, and he names these different cities. But there, it says in verse 22, and this is important for us now, there were the descendants of Anak. Now, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. Now, that doesn't... Zoan is the city of Tanis, where Israel had worked. So, this city, Hebron, existed 7 years before the city where Israel was located in Goshen, in the land of Goshen, before that city was built. And that's so it's giving you a point of reference. But for significance for us, in verse 22, it tells us the descendants of Anak were there. Now, if you look on down here in this context, when it tells us about this, if you go down to verse 33, we're talking here about Anak. It says, "There, when the spies, there also we saw the Nephilim." This is a very important passage in developing this because it shows us when you go into the other passages here in Moses, that the sons of Anak were Nephilim. And the Nephilim were the individuals back in Genesis chapter 6 They were the product of angels, fallen angels, demons, taking on human form and marrying women and producing through that marriage with women, producing giant children, children that were tall. Now, we have Og, king of Bashan, which we're going to find reference to in Moses' writings. And Og, king of Bashan, it tells us his bed was, does anybody remember how long his bed was?
13
feet long. Why do you tell us that a guy has a 13-foot long bed? Because it's telling you the bed was designed to fit him. It's not that this guy just liked to have a lot of room to stretch out in. It's that he was very tall. So you've got a man that's about 12 feet. So I am just shy of 6 feet. So you can imagine a person twice my height. We're talking, what? Oh, yeah. Would have also been very large. You have the five sons that live in Gath, Goliath being one of them, but Goliath has four brothers. Goliath is about 9.5 feet tall. So take my height and what go not quite as high as the ceiling in here, and you would have Goliath. These were very tall men, okay? And not only tall but strong, because remember it tells us that the shaft of his spear, remember what a spear is for? A spear is not a javelin. Most people think a javelin is something you throw. A spear has a short sword like that on the end of a long stick, so I don't have to get my sword up here to fight Ben. I can stand back here, and I can poke him from a distance. That's what a spear is. And to hold that, to wield a spear, to have that weight out there, and he says the weight of that was like that of a weaver's beam. So the large beam that they would run in a weaving loom that had to come down and push all that thread down every time to keep bringing it down so that everything would set. That tells you how strong this man was. So not only is Goliath tall, but he's strong. This is different than today. Most people that have today it's not popular. There's my wife could tell you what did they think Lincoln had? What was that? Does anybody else know? Marfar syndrome. That and then there's other things. They used to call them giantism, but that's not appropriate language, and I don't know what they call it. But people that today would be considered exceptionally tall and giants generally are very weak. They usually have fragile skeletal systems. They have a lot of physical problems. Frequently, they end up being hunched over because their bones aren't good. In other words, what you see today. And people that are exceptionally tall like that. We're not talking about tall guys in the NBA, but guys that really are giants. Very different than what the Nephilim were. The Nephilim were tall, strong. They would have been the epitome of what people thought, this is what a man should be, big and strong.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
So the second Peter says that God didn't reserve the judgment on the angels or spare them and cast them into hell and committed them to Tartarus. Why? Not all of them? He just did some of them?
I would
say more angels than
offspring.
No.
The Nephilim are offspring, but remember, God destroyed the Nephilim Noah's day through the flood. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there weren't any Nephilim from them afterwards. But the scriptures tell us that the Nephilim were in the earth in those days, let me go back to Genesis 6, I think is where it states this. Yeah, Genesis 6:4, it says, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children, or bore to them. It doesn't say children, it's just they bore to them. And these were mighty men, men of a reputation, men of a name. They were famous. Okay.
Okay, so if they had the flood and they were all killed, then where did they come from?
It says the same thing in verse 4. It tells you. It says this happened when the sons of God came into the daughters of men. Were there demons on the earth when Jesus walked the earth? There were demons. So that tells us that not every fallen angel was involved in what happened in Noah's day. Some of them did that. but some of them didn't, because some of them were around to possess people and do different things when Jesus walked the earth. And a significant number, because remember, more than once, Jesus comes across people that have more than just a demon, but as those one man, he's got a legion of demons. Remember what a legion is? 6,000. So that's, and that's just one individual that has 6,000, not to mention all the other people that were having problems. And in the future, during the tribulation period, the future Daniel 70th week, we're also going to have problems with demons out there. They will have problems. Demons will be part of what Satan is doing. So, and Ephesians tells us that when you face Satan, you're not always personally facing. Frequently, when you're facing Satan, you're facing one of his demons. Because that's what it tells you. It says it's spiritual powers that are in the heavenlies. There, Satan spends his time night and day before the Father making accusation. When it says he goes about to and fro in the earth, that would be like saying Patton fought a great war after the Battle of the Bulge. Well, Patton himself wasn't fighting the war. He's directing his troops. Those are the guys that are actually out there manning those tanks and everything like that. And they're the ones that are actually out there with the spot with the binoculars watching the war and transmitting the information back to Patton to say, oh, the Germans are over that river. We have to take that bridge and that river and keep it, and so on and so forth. In other words, in the same way that Patton was directing a war from back here, Satan is directing this warfare through his demons down here in this earth. And Paul tells us that precisely in Ephesians 6. That when you're dealing with Satan's methods, but you're actually dealing with his demons. They're the ones that actually are attacking you. But it's always Satan's attack, in the same way they say, Patton attacked us. Well, he didn't actually drive the tank and pull the trigger. See?
He was right.
But he wasn't. He was actually in the back. I actually had a man sat in my class that was a radio man in the tent that Patton was in. He was he ran the meat locker in the town I grew up in. What? I want to say Elwood Geary, but his last name was Elwood, and I can't remember his first name right now. It was just always Mr. Elwood to me. He was our neighbor for a while, but he ran the meat locker a block and a half from us, and he was a radio man on the front in one of the tents where they always were about a mile or two back from the front, and he actually got to meet Patton. Well, he was in the same tent with him while he listened to Patton barking and yelling at people, is what he put it. On more than one occasion, several occasions that he was at up there. Anyway, that hopefully is an illustration. Now, going back then to answering Leslie's question, all of that is to say that there were a lot of demons that weren't involved in Noah's day. Those demons that weren't involved were not then incarcerated. So some of the ones that were left free carried this out again after the flood, but they didn't carry it out to the degree that they did during the time of Noah. In fact, if you remember, if you look in Genesis chapter 6, Genesis chapter 6, when God was... I've got to find my statement here. I'm just going to start reading here, and maybe I'll find it. Verse 5, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man's heart was great on the earth, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the day. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things, because remember, even the creatures were involved, and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was righteous and blameless in his time. Noah walked with God. And Noah was the father of three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Verse 11, now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God. The earth was filled with violence. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. So in other words, why is Noah the one that gets saved? Because if I read that, when it says in verse 12, all flesh had corrupted its way, Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives were the only ones who were in some way not involved with and tainted with what these spirit beings were doing. So we're talking about that many people. And by the time of Noah, you probably have a population of probably over a billion people on the earth. So that's a lot of people that were involved in what was going on. And it tells us, back in verse 4, these were famous men. People like these guys. People like them. What?
Okay. The flood killed everyone that was on the earth.
Right.
But in 1 Corinthians 15, it names all flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another of flesh of animals, another of fish, another of birds. So anything outside the ark, birds, men, animals, died, but the fish did not.
Right.
So that would explain sometimes the thing of leviathans. Or
actually, according to Job, Leviathan was God's creation.
Than so, other,
yeah,
other
but there may have been some perversions on that. There may have been, yeah, that's speculation. But yeah, there that may have been. So, but all this now, this question and talking about the Nephilim and the sons of Anak is very important when we read this about what these people, how these people are going to respond. So let's go on and let's go back up to verse 23 in Numbers 13. Back to. And I've got some other scriptures there. You can go over and look in Deuteronomy. You can find out that these people were very tall, but it's going to tell us that here in this passage too. So verse 23, and it says, "And then they came to the valley of Eshcol. From there they cut down a branch and a single cluster of grapes." And the word cluster is the word Eshcol. That's why this is called Eshcol. A cluster of grapes. "And they carried it on a pole between two men." I've picked grapes before. I picked grapes for Pipers. I picked grapes with Stan and Linda. I picked grapes at Mr. Crabtree's. I've never had a cluster of grapes that I wouldn't feel foolish putting on a pole to carry. The fact they had to carry it on a pole between two people tells us that's how big this cluster of grapes were. These were big. Okay. Plus, on top of that, they also brought some of the pomegranates and some of the figs. That place was called the Valley of Eshcol because of the cluster, because that's the word, which the sons of Israel cut down from there. Verse 25, "And when they returned from spying out the land, at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation, and they showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told them and said, 'We went into the land where you sent us. It certainly does flow with milk and honey.'" Obviously, that's a metaphor for the fact that this is a very generous land. Milk and honey is that's talking about. That's sweet, okay? It's good for you. And it says, "And this is its fruit." They show them the grapes. "Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong. The cities are fortified, okay? They're living in fortresses. They've got walls around these cities. They're not in camps that you can just run up and attack. And they're very large cities. They're great. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak, the seed of Anak, those that were born to Anak there," going back to what we had, again, back up in verse 22. "Amalek is living in the land." Again, having a reputation in there. "Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, the southland, and then the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." And all of these people had big people in them. In fact, when you read the account elsewhere, it actually tells you that these Nephilim or Rephaim were also known as the Emim, and these people called them the Anim. And so they all had names because they all had these people living amongst them. The Philistines weren't all giants, but the Philistines had some giants among them. See? So all these people had these sons of Anak among them. But verse 30 then, as these people are complaining about all this, Caleb quieted the people before Moses, said, "We should all, by all means, go up and take possession of the land. We will surely overcome it." And it was fun reading this in the Hebrew, because I always like the way Hebrew emphasizes things. Because literally it's, "To go up, and possess it, we can. It's literally what he says. I mean, he doubles up the verb. That's the way they say, we can really do it. In verse 31, "And the men who had gone up with him said, 'We're not able to go up.'" They use the same word, but they only use it once. "Against this, for these people are too strong." And so they gave the sons of Israel a bad report. And the word bad report is a word, is a Hebrew word that meant they slandered. They slandered the land then, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we've gone and spying it out, it's a land that eats up its people. And all the people whom we saw in it, they're of great size. They're men of great measure. It's talking about their stature, how tall these are. So again, he's telling us the same thing we've seen in other passages about that. We also saw there the Nephilim, and this again was important because it ties the Nephilim from Genesis 6 in here with the Anakim. The sons of Anak, they are part of the Nephilim, and we are like what? Well, if you're walking around at this height, and you've got people that are 12 to 13 feet high, or even 9 feet high, you're going to feel. I remember seeing when Peg and I were dating, we were walking on the campus one night and we saw the center for the University of Northern Iowa basketball team. He's walking and his girlfriend standing beside him. Literally, her head came about there on his side. And Peg and I walked around and we started laughing, going, that is weird. I wonder how he reaches. What does he have to kiss her, you know, say goodnight to her at her dorm? Oh, picks her up. Oh, that's the way he did it. Like he picked up his kiss. He was big. He was not only real much taller, but he was just strapping, and she was just a little teeny thing. Anyway, but he says, here, think about that, comparison. We became like grasshoppers in our own sight, so that we were in their sight. We're small. What do you do with grasshoppers? Well, I know they try to jump away from you, but what do? You step on them. You're just nothing to them. That brings us then to chapter 14. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and they cried, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation of them, oh, that we had died in the land of Egypt. See, remember, they're only a little over 2 years out of Egypt. And they're going, would it have been better to stay back there and die back there? Or would that we had died in the wilderness? Remember, they've been traveling through the wilderness for a short time, for a couple of months, coming from Egypt into up to Sinai, and then probably for a short space from there up from Sinai to get up to Kadesh, because that was a good little distance in there. Verse 3, and why is the Lord then bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Verse 3 is important. Notice the next phrase. Our wives and our little ones will become prey. King James has, or the New American Standard has the word plunder here. It's prey, P-R-E-Y, like the prey of a wolf or of a lion. So he says, they'll become prey. Would it not be better for us to turn around and go back to Egypt? Let us return to Egypt? That's going to come back to bite them. Verse 3 actually, again, when you talk about this matter of faith, and this comes up when Paul writes this over in Hebrews, but this applies maybe even to us, to Ben still got some, you still have some. But I've watched lots of parents make bad decisions on the will of God because of their kids. I think God wants me to do this, but I don't really want to move the children. How would they ever handle that? All their friends are here. And they don't want to do those things. And they make decisions. And you know what the thing is? How would you like it if your kids found out you didn't do God's will because of me? That's not a good thing. You have to put that on the shoulders of your kids. Your kids will survive. If God wants you, you know, think about, I always think of the Bells. They raised their four kids over there in Africa, and now one of their daughters is doing it in one country, and their other daughter is doing it in another country like that, and they're raising them over there because that's where God wants them to be. And they could say, well, we've got children. We probably shouldn't be over here in Africa. Well, you know what? You're where God wants you to be. That's the safest place in the world for you to be. And if God wants you to be there and he's going to choose to take you home by some violent thing where you're at, then that's the way God's going to do it. But for you to sit and say, oh, our wives and our children will become prey if we go and do that. Like Israel, learn from them. And sit there and go, I don't want to do that. Now, they might be using their wives and children as an excuse for going in there. But I'm saying this as a father. I know what it's like to be afraid of doing certain things for fear of how it's going to affect my kids. Any of you other dads ever feel like that? Are you ever a little intimidated about doing things because you're worried, because you worry a little bit about your kids? I know I have. So there probably is a little bit of legitimacy to their statement here in terms of their concern. Verse 4. So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and go back to Egypt. In other words, they don't go to Moses and say, hey, take us back. They said, we're going to appoint, we're going to put a leader for ourselves. And Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. It's amazing how often you run through this in the Gospels and the Old Testament, that this was a way you showed intense distress over something. It was a way of publicly show this, to grab at your outer garment and literally tear this outer garment that you had. And that's what these guys, they're standing there tearing their clothes to show this grief over this. They spoke to the congregation and the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. It's very good. In fact, in the Hebrew, it is good. Very, very. They double the varies up. That's the way they say it. And if the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land. Notice verse 8. It's not that if you went back and looked at Caleb's statement in verse 30, we can possess it. If you just looked at that by itself, you might think, well, Caleb, you know, are you really thinking this through? But Caleb has, because what he says in verse 8 is, if the Lord's pleased with us, he'll bring us into the land and give it to us, a land which flows in milk and honey. Don't rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. He turns this around. You thought your wives and children, they'll be our prey. We'll go after them. Their protection has literally been lifted up away from them, and the Lord is with us. Don't be afraid of them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. And the only thing that protected them was the fact that the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. In other words, God shows up, boom, scares the daylights out of these guys to say, back off. You leave Caleb and Joshua alone, as well as Moses and Aaron. Verse 11. I think we can cover all of this evening here that I want. Verse 11, and the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? How long will they not believe in me? Again, this is one of those multiple passages, as I said, where God's always questioning, why don't you believe? You don't believe. Why don't you believe? Why will they not believe me? Despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst, if you remember Ben's study that he did at the Bible conference this year, signs are intended to encourage a person to believe, but they don't normally do that. Usually. Now, under the law, they helped, but normally when people saw signs, even in the Old Testament and the Gospels, oftentimes people still didn't believe. Gideon asks for three specific signs there, to be sure. That's right.
Still doubting God the whole time.
Verse 12, he says, I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. This is God talking to Moses. And when he says, I'm going to smite them with pestilence, he's talking about Israel. Moses, I'll wipe them out, and I'll start the nation with you. Still ultimately would fulfill the promise going back to Abraham. But remember, the promise had also come to Isaac and then to Jacob. And what did Jacob do? Jacob actually offered a blessing as he was on his deathbed for all 12 of those sons. And who wrote that down? Moses. So Moses knows what God's promised ultimately. And so he puts this in here. He says, and then Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear of it. For by thy strength you did bring this people from their midst. And they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people. For thou, O Lord, art seen eye to eye while thy cloud stands over them. I do not know why the New American Standard is writing this in Old English, because it's getting hard to read. And thou dost go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night. For thou dost slay this people as one man, and then the nations who have heard of your fame will say, because the Lord could not bring the people into the land which he promised them by oath. Therefore, he slaughtered them in the wilderness, gives up on them. Now, what's important in here is when God makes this proposal to Moses, and I write questions down. I don't know if you ever write questions down when you're studying, questions you want to answer, such as, was this really what God wanted to do? Was this really God's plan? Think about it, for those of you that have been in Jim's class, was God really going, oh, we're going to go with solution B, because plan A didn't work out, so we're going to go with plan B here. No. I really think what he's doing is he's testing something about Moses. The scriptures tell us that, I have the verse written down here, I think on the my next page of notes. Yes, in Numbers 12:3, it tells us about Moses. If you go to verse 1, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? And the Lord heard it. Now we have this little parenthesis. Now the man Moses was very humble. If you have old King James, they say he was meek. But it's literally, it's the word onon, which is low. We actually, this is one of the words that was used when we were talking about wealth a couple of years ago. We did that church study on wealth. And this is used for a person that's pressed down low. And he says, he was a low man, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. In other words, the point is, Moses would never take this on himself. Moses would never go around saying, hey God, I'll be the one. Moses would never be the one to go, pick me, pick me, pick me. This was not Moses. In fact, Moses would be the one that would be, we know this from the earlier in the book of Exodus, how about that guy over there? Not me. Don't pick me. Moses never would have taken this on himself. Moses was never looking to aggrandize himself before anybody. So when you have this being proposed to him, it's again, it's a demonstration of Moses' character that despite what the people are doing, Moses isn't going, oh, God, you're right. I'm so sick and tired. Start over with me. My people, my kids will be better. Moses doesn't do that. In fact, what Moses really looks out for is whose character. He's really looking out for God's character and God's reputation.
But even when God said, you're going to be my guy to go get Israel, he's going, oh, pick someone else. He
exactly.
That way,
yeah. So you can see that this has always been. He's never been a person that's wanted to take anything on himself. About the only time he ever did was when he was down in Egypt and he saw the slave, the taskmaster, beating the other guy and he kills him, thinking I can lead the people. But that, I tell you, that backfired on just no time quick, and you don't ever see him trying that again. So he says in verse 17, now I pray thee, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you have declared. In other words, keep doing what you've already said, Lord. The Lord is slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. Where did Moses hear that? See how many of you have been paying attention on Sunday mornings. When did Moses hear that? The Lord is slow to anger, abundant loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. He heard that when he was on the mount, when Israel had built had made the calves, and God said then, I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses pled for the people that time too. And then he says, but Lord, if you want me to keep doing this, please, I ask you, show me your glory. I need to know you're going to go with us because I can't do this without you. And God says, I'll cause all my goodness to pass before you. And he puts him in the cleft of the rock, puts his hand up there, comes up and then turns and lets him see his backside. I still don't know what that means when it says he saw his backside. I don't know if God came and showed himself in some sort of a human type form. I don't know. But as he goes before Moses, he declares all these qualities that are true of him. And Moses is reciting back to God what God had said to him. You are slow to anger. You are abundant in loving kindness or loyal love. It's back in the book of Exodus. Probably you've got a footnote on in your Bible there or a reference if you'd look at the chain references on it. Forgiving iniquity. What?
This is Exodus 26 and then 34.
Okay. Forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth. And remember, that's of those that continue to do that. If your kids straighten up, they're going to do that. In fact, it was just last week Peg and I were reading about Josiah. His dad wasn't so good, but Josiah comes along and Josiah does what's right. And God doesn't punish Josiah for his father's misdeeds.
But Josiah's
son got right up on the throne and did what was evil in the sight of God. But then Solomon said that. You can do everything to raise a child right, and that child still may choose to do what they're going to do. And Solomon bemoaned that. That really grieved him. But that's the way it is. You can only control your life. You can't decide how your kids are going to act when they're grown. Verse 19. I never thought about that.
Me either. I just learned that.
What?
Josiah's father was evil. He came on the scene and he had the influence of a
good priest.
He wanted to do God's ways. His own boys were evil, but he really, it was the next, just a few years after
were carried off.
Were they under Josiah?
I think they were born under that reign.
Probably.
And so probably their parents raised them up in the law, and so that's why they wanted to do what God wanted them to do.
Numbers 14:19, it says, pardon, I pray thee, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. So the Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have sinned, here it is now, here's the punishment that he brings on them. In verse 22, I'm trying to stay on target with my notes here. In verse 22, he says, surely all the men have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, and have not listened to my voice. They shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurn me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. It's really interesting. We'll get there eventually when we hit Joshua. Caleb's in his 80s when they take the land. And he actually leads. He doesn't sit back. He's not Patton calling the charges from 2 miles from the front. Caleb leads a party up a mountain to conquer a mountain and the thing, and he's in his 80s. And don't think of it in terms of the fact that these people live, that was the blessing from God that he got to do that. Because by the time these people are getting this age, they're living about our lifespan now again. So to be 80 meant you were probably old and it was hard, and you didn't do things you did when you were 40.
The battle back then was hand-to-hand unless you had hornets chasing them out.
Yes. And then it goes on, it says in verse 25, And now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. So he's going to send them back. Verse 27, we find that they're grumbling. And then verse 29 promises that your corpse are going to fall in the wilderness. Even all of your numbered men. Numbered men meant those that were conscripted for military service. All those 20 years old and upward. Verse 30, surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to settle you, except for Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Now verse 31 is interesting in light of what they complained about earlier, and we made a big deal about this. Your children, however, whom you said would become prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. In other words, the very ones that you used them as an excuse for why you weren't going to do God's will, they're going to see it. He's going to just, it's almost a slap in the face to these people. You so disbelieved. But as for you, your corpses shall fall in the desert, and your sons shall shepherd for 40 years in the wilderness, and they shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness. In other words, instead of settling in the land and becoming farmers, raising grapes and figs and barley and such, they're going to shepherd out there in the wilderness, which means you just keep, it's a nomadic life. You move from one place, your livestock eats everything up. Now we've got to move several miles this distance. And for 40 years, they're just going to be moving around doing what? I always wondered, but what did they do walking around out there for 40 years? Well, they walked around doing what you did if you had livestock. You're chasing green forage. You're chasing forage. And when the animals have eaten it off to the ground or it's getting close, you move them off to the next place. That's what they spent 40 years doing. Imagine spending nothing but 40 years. Now, some people spend their whole lives doing that, but that's what their sons were going to do. But I think it's very important. In the rest of the chapter, just in a nutshell, from verse 39, you've got some of them that are going, oh, okay, we'll go. And he goes, no, you're not going to do it. You can't do it. No, we'll go. And they try to go in, and the people of the land come up and chase them off, and people fall, and it doesn't succeed. Most of us know that. The failure in this chapter is a failure to take God's promise seriously, to not believe his promise that he can actually take them into the land. Now, that we don't have that promise, but we have a lot of other promises. I think, as I was telling you, I did this paper on faith and the faith, and in the Thursday night Bible study, we're actually going through the promises. And just me going through the New Testament, I've compiled over 100 promises that God's made for us in the New Testament. That's just me. I bet if you went through there, you'd find promises I didn't collect. God's made a lot of promises to us. But as I go through and read those and study them, one of the things I was impressed in a negative way is how poorly I take some of those promises, how often I don't take seriously some of the promises that God has made. Some of them I take seriously. Some of them I don't. And the study's been good for me. It's been a challenge on how I look at things. Because God has made promises to me, just like he made promises to Israel. And I don't want to be like Israel, standing there at my own personal Kadesh Barnea going, God, you can't do it. You can't do it. You can't do it. The kids will die if I do it.
Sometimes the promises people are ignorant because they don't know the Bible.
That's true too, yeah. But I'm saying if you do know those promises, and that's what happens with us. Sometimes, you know, we sit in a Bible study or we read the Bible ourselves and we come across these promises and we're going, huh? But we don't always take them seriously. So we'll come back next week. Well, not next week. Next week we'll be down at the park on Wednesday evening. Come down and participate down there. But we'll be looking at some comparison and contrasts when we return. We'll resume this study tonight at the 9th, right? Okay, Father, we're thankful that you are the God of truth. We're thankful for the promises that you have made all through your word to various people, even those promises to Abraham and Israel. And we're thankful for the promises that you have made to us. And help us as believers, as we grow and mature, to take with seriousness and with faith the promises you've made to us, and not to allow other things to dissuade us, to cause us in fear. You saw with these people here just how powerful of a motivator fear is to get people to not do what you want them to do. Help us also as believers to be those that would not be moved by fear, but would put faith in you, because you're the one that has made